Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and today we are going to be looking at some non-chemical ways to control weeds on the show, and we got a couple of guests for you. From Old Brick Botanical Gardens in Madison, the director of the gardens is with us, Samantha Peckham. Hi, Samantha. Thanks for joining in.
Hello. It's wonderful to be here.
And with us as well, she's been around a long time, but she's still young. I don't know how she does it. Erin Presley is a horticulturist at Old Brick Botanical Gardens. And Erin's good to see your smiling face, too.
Thanks, Larry. You're too kind.
As we move along today, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What would you like to know about controlling weeds? We've got some kind of cool ways to do it, or they have, and maybe you have some other gardening questions as well. Join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Samantha Peckham, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your professional background.
Well, let's see. So I'm from Madison. I grew up in the area, and I actually went to UW. I have a degree in landscape architecture from UW-Madison here, and I worked at Old Brick for about 12 years as a horticulturist. I actually worked with Erin for quite a while of that, and then relocated to the Chicago area and was down there for about 10 years and worked for a couple different public gardens, and then most recently for an independent landscape design firm. And then when the opportunity to come back to Old Brick popped up, I couldn't resist.
I don't blame you. It's a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. Always lots going on there. There's been a lot of changes construction-wise. Anything long-term? You probably haven't had a chance much to think about. What the heck are we going to do long-term for plans? But what's in mind?
So we're starting on planning process for kind of our long-term growth and development. But right now we've got work going on in our conservatory, which is actually closed right now. We'll be opening back up in mid-June. But we've been having some assessment work done on that. And then the Thai garden is under restoration as well. Yeah. The gardens are open, but the salon is being restored, and they're just doing a beautiful job on that. We're hoping to get that back opened up later this summer, maybe early fall.
Yeah, but the gardens look pretty nice now, Erin.
Oh, the gardens look spectacular. Yeah. And one thing that's always amazing is kind of no matter what time we have guests coming, they'll always be like, I can't believe how much is blooming out there. And like, it's so green so early. And so a lot of that we owe to the very layered plantings that we feature throughout all of our garden spaces that have just interest that really develops and crescendos through the whole season. But a big part of what we'd like to touch on today is that early season layer that's coming up, you know, as soon as the snow is melting. We have obviously beautiful bulbs to enjoy the flowers of, but a lot of other just smaller, lower growing plants that are covering the ground and starting to push out weeds, keep weed seeds from germinating, cutting down on the amount of mulch that we have to have, and just really creating a really lush atmosphere from the very early seasons of the garden.
You know, that brings to mind, and maybe go to you, Samantha, for this, targeting or reducing weeds in a non-chemical way, as Erin's talking about here. What is the policy at the gardens when it comes to controlling weeds?
So we do use a lot of different methods for controlling weeds. We definitely try and focus on using non-chemical means, so using things like different styles of planting, and also just, you know, manual hand weeding and things like like Dutch hose, which are a wonderful tool to reducing weeds, and as well as mulch, things like that. But we do still use chemicals when needed,
you have
especially to deal with invasive plants and things like that.
Yeah, well, mulch, green mulch. Erin, tell us about green mulch and the benefits.
So when a lot of people, I think of their garden spaces, you right away want to think about the big flashy flowers and the phlox and the coneflowers. But what sometimes goes overlooked is sort of the base layer that's creating a matrix for all of your other plants to grow up through. And so one key class of plants that we use to kind of create that early emerging green carpet is a variety of sedges. And sedges are plants that are grass-like. They're not grasses, but typically they start coming up and greening up a lot earlier than a lot of your typical ornamental grasses you might have in your garden beds. And then they're kind of just covering the ground and creating a nice backdrop for your flowers while they are suppressing weeds. And so, you know, a real easy starter sedge for a lot of people that's pretty readily available is Carex pennsylvanica. Pennsylvania sedge, and that's a nice one because it kind of can run and creep around the bases of other plants. And so later in the season, as your gardens are developing over the top, the sedges can still tolerate shade. So they're fine if they have lots of other stuff kind of growing and blooming in layers above them. But at this time of the year, they're really critical because in places that otherwise might just be bare, you have something growing and keeping the weeds away.
Yeah.
And we use a wide variety of other plants that can kind of create that matrix layer as well.
Yeah, I would. Is it too late to put those in now, or plant sedges, put them in?
No, not at all. This is the perfect time to do, you know, to add plants and to do planting. So yes, it's definitely, it's never too late to add sedges.
and they don't outcompete the other things that you have planted.
No, for the most part, you know, the sedges really work beautifully with other plants and are sort of well-behaved companions for them.
Well, tell us about layered or matrix, mm-hmm. I guess it's called, planting. Describe that and how it deters weeds.
Yeah, so the idea behind that is to actually think about your garden more in like a horizontal or vertical layers. Mm-hmm. So thinking of things at the ground level and then more at the mid-level and then upper level. So if you think of the ground level being like what Aaron was talking about with our things like sedges, also smaller creeping plants, like some of our native sedums, things like that, anything that will creep along on the ground and kind of intermingle in between your other plants. And then within above that, you would have larger things like hostas and taller perennials, maybe smaller shrubs. And then you would have these sort of a carpet that those would be popping out of. And then even on top of that, then you could have more of your structural plants like trees and larger shrubs and things like that. So really thinking about it in overlapping layers, because then that really helps to cover the surface of the ground and to cover it at all times of the growing season. So starting from very early in spring through late fall.
So, they're kind of in the same area.
Yeah, and so they're actually, a lot of people, it's a little bit, uncomfortable for some folks because it appears, especially when you're planting these kind of gardens, like you're really packing a lot of plants in there because you're really putting things quite close together. But if you get more familiar with how the plants grow and things like that, it really works well together because many of our, the lower story plants are much more shade tolerant. So you can actually, even in a full sun area, have a combination of shade and sun plants because the larger, more structural plants will shade the things at the bottom level.
So it can be done without having to hire somebody to come in and show.
Yes, that. Yes. All it takes is a walk through Ulbrich, and you can kind of just take a look at some of the things that we're doing to get ideas for different plants to use and sort of how that can actually look in your own garden.
Let's talk about herbs in the herb garden. You know a lot about the herb garden, Erin.
Yeah, and actually, when Samantha was here in her past life, she was actually the herb gardener as well. So I kind of picked up the torch when she went off to Chicago for a while. So we both have a deep love of herbs and even background in the herb garden at Ulbrich.
So you have something, what does it consist of? And I want to know what's new.
So we have a few. One thing that's very important for people to know is that we're renovating our mint garden. And I am sure that you have had many callers call in and talk about having mints that get really rambunctious and crazy in their yards. And one of our really beloved areas had mints that were all planted in these steel rings. And even those steel rings, after, you know, 15 years or so, are just, they can't hold back anymore.
Yeah, the mints are winning.
the mints are winning. So we're doing a renovation to the mint garden this summer. Mm-hmm. So that I'm really looking forward to. And we're actually going to create a little bit more of a vertical tiered planting bed for them to live in, so that they'll be kind of separated into some different, again, layers, kind of is one of the themes that we're talking about. So we're going to be adding some vertical interest and vertical planting space and put the mints back in. So that's one minor thing. And then the other thing that we're really excited about is we are, again, collaborating with community members that are Hmong in the Madison area to create a Hmong-themed garden at Ulbrich. And we had a garden of this style last year, and we have a great young lady who is the garden facilitator, Sabrina Herr, and she is coming back this summer to facilitate the garden and programming. So we'll be having some pop-up activities through the summer. We're in the process of having our signage actually has written translations that are in Hmong right now. But we're getting close to having an audio component where people can scan a QR code and then actually hear a recording of Sabrina and her mom reading the sign text, which is really interesting because the Hmong language, from what I understand, is a tonal language. And so you can have different words that are pronounced the same, and just based on your inflection and kind of your tonality, they mean different things. So it's really musical, beautiful language to listen to. And then we're gearing up for actually a celebration of the Hmong garden and Hmong culture and arts on August 22nd. And we're hosting an artist from the Twin Cities, an artist and author, to do some painting demos. We're going to have cooking demos. And one of our other goals is to be actually able to invite some Hmong market vendors to come in and treat us to some of their garden goodies and have a little mini pop-up farmers market at Ulbrich later in August. So
should be fun.
It's going to be really, really awesome. Yeah, we had some really great engagement and good experiences last year, so we're excited to build on that theme again this upcoming summer.
Marty in Bayfield has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Marty.
Hi. I just saw this online yesterday. Have you heard about something called cardening? C-A-R-D-E-N. You have a garden in your car. It's like on the dashboard. Like, honest to God, you can grow herbs. If you haven't done the Google on it, it's pretty, I don't know what to think. What do you think?
I think that would be very weather dependent. You know, I think it's a great way to make use of your car, but I think it might be a little bit of a struggle once it gets a bit warmer than it is right now. But yeah, interesting for sort of a greenhouse effect. But I think, yeah, temperature would be a challenge to control.
I'm just looking online right now, and I'm seeing cars with things on the hood.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of non-functional cars that have been turned into planters and things like that, but never, I don't think I've seen a driving car that would
plant. The rise of gardening. Hmm. Why people are growing plants in cars and everywhere else. Oh, and there's somebody, there's a photo of somebody growing a bunch of things in the hatchback porch of their car.
Different way to think about urban gardening.
Some people just, they need to garden so much. They can't even avoid it when they're in their car.
Oh, man.
We're not quite at that point yet, but maybe in retirement.
Oh, boy. Samantha Peckham and Aaron Presley, our guests today, both from Ulbrich Botanical Gardens. Samantha's the director, and Aaron, the horticulturist there. Of course, Samantha has plenty of horticultural experience herself to go along with the director part. Questions for them today as we talk about flowers and plants that you can use to kind of get rid of the weeds that might be in your garden. And of course, take other questions too. I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or go ahead and email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guests from Olbrich Botanical Gardens, the director, Samantha Peckham, and horticulturist, Aaron Presley. Questions for them? I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm going to go back to herbs for just a minute. What are the best herbs in your mind to get if somebody wants to just get started with herbs, growing them?
Oh, for just for starters, I always think one of the most versatile herbs in the kitchen usually is parsley, because a lot of people already have some good ideas to do things with parsley. But parsley is actually really a pollinator powerhouse as well, because it's a host for swallowtail caterpillar larvae. So you can invite some really neat butterflies into your yard. Also fennel is, and dill are hosts for swallowtails as well. So those kind of do double duty as far as inviting some beneficial insects. And then if people are looking to grow from seed, now is a really great time to start basil in the garden. And I think basil, again, is a plant that, and there are so many awesome varieties. There's, you know, Thai or licorice basil that is a component of a lot of Southeast Asian cuisine. If you're looking to do brewing of beverages, holy basil makes really wonderful tea that's utilized in a lot of like Ayurvedic tradition. And again, Southeast Asian, you know, kind of applications. Then a lot of us are more, you know, have a familiarity with some of the classic Italian basils. Yeah. There's purple basil, and that's one that germinates like really readily. You can grow a lot of it, because if you're making pesto or something like that, you need some nice big bundles. And as soon as the weather starts to warm up, like we're kind of getting pretty much past the frost danger, it's a great time to sow basil, either really easy to grow in a pot or direct sow out in your garden beds.
So lots there to consider. Let's go to Barbara in Cross Plains, who has, I think, a different kind of question. Let's go there. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Hey, I'm so glad you're on today, because we have been driving around in Cross Plains. We're back here at our second home this last week, enjoying all the sunny days. And everywhere we went, on Highway 14, 60 along the river, or 78 to Baraboo, we saw these gorgeous clumps of beautiful purple pinkish flowers. We first thought, oh, look at the phlox blooming. Then we did some research, and it sounds like it's something called Dame's Violet, and it's invasive, so it's not something we should really be excited about. It's glorious all along railroad tracks.
Well, Barbara, thanks for calling. Samantha, let's talk about that for a bit.
Yes, so that what you are seeing right now is Dame's Rocket, and it is an invasive species in the Midwest. It is a beautiful one, I'd say, but it is one that's very, very obvious at this time of year, because you can see the patches of flowers in any shades of sort of pale pink to brighter pink to sort of a lavender purple. But it is one that will tend to take over in spots that are maybe a little bit disturbed or you know, don't have a whole lot of other things growing in them, but it can push out a lot of our invasive species in woodlands and woodland edges and like along roadsides.
So it's an invasive. So we don't want it.
It'd be better not to have it, yes. It's a very pretty one. And it's one, it does, it can be pulled very easily. It's one that does seed quite a bit. So if you are pulling it out, if you have it in your yard, you'll probably be seeing it coming back for several years if you do pull it out. But it is one that, I would say it's a little bit easier to control than something like garlic mustard or, you know, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Barbara, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. I had an email from Terry He believes he has Queen Anne's lace growing from the middle of his ground cover. He's used to pulling it out. At times he gets roots, and at times he just gets stems. It's an annual project, and he has contacted several garden stores, but none of them carry napalm.
Wow.
So Queen Anne's lace.
So that's another challenging one. The nice thing about Queen Anne's lace is that it's a biennial, so that it will come up with foliage the first year and then flowers the next year. So, I'm saying that wrong.
It would have to be rosette of foliage the first year, and then the second year is when it has flowers. So it has a two-year life cycle. So then the plants that are flowering, those actually die after they flower. Mm-hmm. But if you're able to catch them in the first year, you have a full season where all they're going to do is produce leaves before they have flowers that second year. So that's kind of one thing that helps you, you know, time your management to be able to really tackle that. And another one that's interesting, an interesting fact, is that Queen Anne's lace is actually in the same genus and is basically what our cultivated carrot is. So if you think of like the long carrot root structure, it is a taproot. And what's going to really help you control that is really going after as much of that root as you can. And I would suggest a garden tool that every person should have in their arsenal, which is a hori-hori knife, or you might just know it as a weeding knife or a garden knife. But it's a long, skinny-bladed knife-shaped tool with a really sturdy handle and a little bit of a curve to it. Usually has a blade that's about 6 inches long at least, so it allows you to plunge down into the soil right alongside that taproot of the Queen Anne's lace and kind of get some good leverage to really be able to crank up on that whole root structure.
Root it out. Yeah, mm-hmm. Somebody else talked about the hori-hori.
Yeah, they're great tools. That's
When we were talking about what tools should you have.
That's one, yes, definitely.
Yeah.
But for sure with the Queen Anne's lace, if you can keep it, if it is putting flowers on, if you can pull those flowers off, that's the biggest thing to keep it from reseeding.
In fact, Jeff just let me know that it was Melinda Myers who was talking about that as one of her favorite tools in the garden. Well, let's talk about edibles for a little bit. Edibles can work in the flower garden.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I think edibles make wonderful plants, and many of them are really beautiful plants and can be worked into existing perennial beds or, you know, with trees and shrubs and things like that. And I think that's one thing that folks sometimes get stuck on if they don't feel like they have enough space for a specific vegetable garden or for edible gardening. You can throw them in anywhere and you'll really see how beautiful the plants actually are and how productive a space can be with both ornamental and edibles in it.
So you have plenty of them. And actually you brought some things.
Yes.
I've got these little fruits that are, what am I holding in my hot little hand here?
These are actually some treats from our tropical conservatory.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yes. Okay. Yes, so tell me what I'm holding here.
What you have in your hand there is a rose apple, and if you jiggle it a little bit in your ear, you have to move. Yep. Okay.
Oh, I can feel.
The seed rolling around in there, and then bite into it and don't eat the seed. But the flesh is a little kind of like leathery. It's not real juicy, but it has an amazing aroma and taste of rose.
Hmm.
Yeah, they're really good.
Really. Good. Pardon me while I eat away.
Just chop away on that. Yeah.
So this has got, you got to be growing this inside.
Yes, that is out of the conservatory. Yes.
And what it's rose apple?
Rose apple.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a dandy. Now what am I holding in my hand?
So that is a kumquat, also from our conservatory.
Of course it is.
And so that is in the citrus family, and it's one that you can actually eat the whole thing. You can eat the skin and the interior flesh. They've got quite a punch as far as being citrusy, but they're really good.
Ooh, we're bringing you some citrus.
Oh, if people can only see me now, I'm puckered up for sure.
Yes, maybe better for like jams or chilies, things like that.
Oh, but I like the taste.
But really nice flavor. Yeah.
It's a really nice flavor. Well, we've got a couple more, but John in Janesville has a question for us. Let's see what John is on John's mind. Hi, John.
Am I on?
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay. So I'm curious. I want the lady's expertise on how to eradicate or control, I guess eradicate would be it, control Canada thistle. I've read a lot of stuff on it. I have a prairie planting around my, about a 1 acre prairie planting around my house. And I know what I'm doing now, but I'm wondering, I can use any other, I'm spraying it individually with Weezy Gone. Just spray on it helps, but I want to know if the other techniques.
You have picked one of the most difficult and dastardly weeds to get rid of.
Yeah.
Do we have any of those at Olbrich?
Do we have Canada thistle? Yeah. I mean, maybe in like one or two spots. We have a few, yes.
We basically, any problem that people out there are seeing as far as weeds, just because we work in a public garden, weeds come in from everywhere. And so,
you know, as good as shoes or whatever.
Yeah, as good a care as you could take of things, you're always going to have problems like that pop up, even in a place where you're really trying to stay on top of it.
Yes, it's amazing how much effort we put in and still still the weeds are tough. In Canada, thistle is probably one of the more challenging ones, especially in the world of restoration, because it can creep into things very quickly and get very difficult to control.
So what do you do at the garden?
At the gardens, we do a lot of manual digging, but then we also do very targeted applications of chemicals for those ones, just because it's really hard for us to stay on top of it otherwise.
Well, you can't get down to the bottom of the roots.
That's another one, like Aaron was talking about. It is a huge taproot, and it's very difficult to just dig it out, and they can seemingly come back from, like, a molecule of root.
Just a little shred of root, yeah.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. And so you, just keep at it?
If you're, as far as what we'll do a lot of times at work is do, and in a restoration setting, this isn't really that realistic, we'll do as best as we can with digging and hand pulling and really get the most out that we can that way, and then proceed with like a chemical control from that point. In more of a restoration type environment, or it sounded like this gentleman was working in like a prairie, the Neil Dibble's book that came out last fall. Have you checked out that book?
Yeah, that he has some great information in there.
He has, it's like something like, I'm not coming up with the title right now, but it's like Prairie Plants for the Garden. And he has a large section of that book that deals specifically with like naturalistic gardens or prairie-esque settings and timing and controls, both in establishment and when you have an existing planting and you have particular weeds in it, and strategies to target those particular weeds. So I would recommend checking out that book. Maybe we can look up the title and make sure we get
Jill will look that up. And in fact, I've had Neil on the show to talk about the book, and I have the book sitting back in my office, and I can't remember the title of it either, but it is
it's a wealth
like
of information.
Book, the book to have for this sort of thing, John. So stay listening, and I'm sure we're going to get the title of that book, or I'll be able to look it up online as we move along. But appreciate the call. Dave in Broadhead has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I have a question about sterilizing soil. I have had horses over the years, and I have a huge manure pile. But it's also, we bed with wood chips, so it takes a long time for it to break down. And I use it, but even as long as it sits there, some of it's been sitting for 3-4 years, it still has weed seeds in it. And my idea was to take a half a 50-gallon drum, put it over my burning pit, and sterilize all the soil to get rid of the weed seeds. But then I wonder, is it going to be any good when I do that? Because I've also killed all the organic organisms in there.
Yeah, that's not a good idea.
Yeah, I would. Sterilizing is, that's sort of an all or nothing thing. And I would probably steer away from complete sterilization because you really want, especially in compost like that, it's probably full of all sorts of fantastic microorganisms and things like that that you really want to hold on to. And it just, I think it would be really challenging to get it free of weed seeds completely. And it might just be kind of something that you have to try and work around as best as possible. I don't know, Aaron,
how big is this pile?
Oh, it's about probably 30 feet long by 15 feet wide by 6 feet deep.
I mean, with something like that, you could try just as you get a flush of germination on the top layer of it, just try turning it periodically to get those weeds to flush out and germinate, and then kind of remix the pile to drown out those weeds that just germinated, to kind of try and get as much of the weed seeds that are in there to germinate, and then just manually kill them off by mixing the pile.
Yeah, that'd be one way to do it. Another way to do it would be to take it in chunks. You're not going to put that whole 30-foot strip 6 feet deep at one time. You could separate out a pile and just put some black plastic over. I mean, and solarize it would probably be about as the best way I can think of, and just do it in chunks. But you've got a gold mine there, actually. You ought to be turning it anyway, to get it to decompose faster. So those are some thoughts, Dave. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Jan in Viroqua, we'll go to you. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. I have serious problems with my wrists, and I need to protect them. So I'm very curious about weeding techniques that would take the pressure off of my wrists. I've been doing what you've been saying with the hori hori and, you know, going down under, but that requires leveraging it up with my hand, and I'd like a way to avoid that as much as possible.
Yeah.
I think really, just in anybody's garden, regardless of if you're experiencing wrist pain or any type of pain, obviously the best way is to get out there really early and to be able to try to knock down weeds when they're small and just as they're germinating. And we have, Samantha had already mentioned previously in the show, a really fabulous tool. It's called a Dutch push hoe. And it's a hoe with an especially long handle. And so you're able to kind of manipulate it a little bit farther out in front of you than you might be used to. But then it really encourages you to stand upright, which is good for posture. And then it has a very sharp diamond-shaped blade on the end of it. So it's really good for sneaking, you know, kind of in and around and underneath perennials without disturbing the good plants that you have there, but be able to knock down small weeds just as they're coming up. So I know with as rainy the spring has been, I've been going around to a lot of my areas and just running the Dutch push hoe over them like weekly. And you're really able to keep on top of things before they become a larger problem. I think also anything that keeps weight off of your wrists while you're working from like a kneeling position is good. So the more that you can use a kneeler or a little bench or something so that you're not, you know, on your knees holding yourself up with one wrist and then also, you know, using your other hand to do weeding, the more that you can just kind of take care of your whole body while you're doing any sort of action. I know both Samantha and I, having worked a lot of years outside on your hands and knees, it really pays the more that you can just start taking care of yourself early on.
Yes. Yes, and I would like what Aaron said, I would highly recommend the Dutch push hoser. It's really a wonderful tool, and it can really just do so much for you for the garden and just for yourself, for giving you a break on your back and your wrists and knees and everything like that.
So probably, and they kind of come in different styles, those Dutch hoes. The one you're talking about has a pointed blade? Is it a...
It's like a stretched out diamond shape. So it's very pointy on the outer edges and then a little fatter in the middle. But it's a really nice size. I would say there may be like 6 inches wide, but it's a really nice size, and they're super sharp, so you can just zip right over the top of the soil and snip things off. It's great for like what Aaron was saying with smaller weeds coming up and just to go through and just zip them right out.
Just swipe them off at
yep,
the base.
You can just sort of
not
like,
dig them out. Just right. swipe them off. Yeah, I'm looking at them and they're anywhere from, I'd say, $45 to maybe $70 or $80 for the.
Yeah, some of them can be a little more pricey, but it's really, you know, the level of tool that you'll have for a very long time, and you can get them resharpened, and you know, it's definitely worth the investment.
Jan, there you go. Thank you. It's funny that the Hori Hori doesn't have you couldn't get a long handled one.
Be
why
like a dagger.
I mean, why couldn't you?
Those might be licensed as a weapon yeah. in some states or something.
Boom. If anybody has any lawn darts, you can probably use one of those.
Because that's what I was thinking. Why couldn't we put a longer handle on the Hori Hori? Mary and Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling about the gentleman with the thistle.
Yeah.
I have a 4-acre restoration I've been working on for 20-ish years to south of Madison. And when we first started, we had a lot of thistle. And our farmer neighbor told us to cut it when the stems are hollow, which is kind of when it just is starting to bloom, and just cut it. And it worked. I mean, it cleared out my thistle within a couple of years. We had none left, and we don't get it anymore.
Yeah. Well, you just kept cutting it when it came up.
Yeah, well, I think it's a biennial, and so it, once it blooms, it's sort of done. And but if you cut it before the seeds get out,
yeah, that's the main thing. Yeah, that's the main thing. Cutting if you're gonna cut it before the seeds have a chance. To work. That, good points, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Alice in Madison, your turn. Hi, Alice.
I have a garden plot in one of our wonderful community gardens, and I've been working for years to try to get the mint and the canary grass under control. I've done cardboard and lots of hand weeding and mulching, but I always have a lot of it every year anyway. So this year I have tried to start with solarizing it by covering it with clear plastic and hoping that it will actually kill that grass. So do you know how long I would have to leave the plastic on? And do you have any other great ideas for finally getting all of the grass and mint out of my soil?
Yeah, that is a challenge. I think solarizing can work, but in our climate, it takes quite a long time. So
takes the whole season.
Yeah,
it?
I would leave it on for the whole entire season.
It's too bad.
Yeah.
Well, you look at what, you know, if you're in Madison, Alice, and if you look outside, there's not a lot of solarization going on a day like today. And we've had, it does take a long time, unfortunately, the whole year. But you know what? Then it's worth it if they're gone.
Yeah, if you can handle one not having it for one season and it works, I think it's a great tool.
Yeah.
It just takes a little patience.
There you go, Alice. Thank you so much. And Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois, we'll go to you. Hi, Anita.
Hi. As a woman and a woman in her 70s with arthritis in both thumbs and both wrists, I was wondering how I'm going to be able to, you know, pull up garlic and get under bad weeds. And I bought this, my favorite tool now is the broad fork, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a broad thing. I get to push down on the handles. I don't have to pull or jerk or twist, and it goes down, and then when you pull it back up, and it's an easy thing to do that. Because, again, to pull it up, you're pushing down on these handles. And so there's no stress on my arms or my hands. And I get to use my upper body strength to the best of its ability. So it really gives me strength. And when I see that, all that stuff come up so easily, it makes me feel powerful.
Yes.
So, and a broad fork, it's like a two-handled job, isn't it? Not what you have, Anita?
Yes, that's exactly what I have. It's two handles. And so even that, it doesn't do anything bad to my balance or anything because you have a handle on each side. And I just love it.
And you push down on the fork part with your foot, I would guess.
Yes, that's right. You just put your foot on that middle, and that's that just stabilizes it a little bit. So there's none of that stress on your hands or anything that's so awful. So, yeah, I think it's great. And, you know, you when you're digging, particularly digging garlic up, you don't know where it is. And you, so it's better to dig down on the side of it and then come up under it without, you know, digging into a garlic.
Yeah, yeah. You have come up with a very good idea, Anita, for somebody with arthritis or even those of us who don't have a whole lot of arthritis, I think would benefit from a broad fork. Mm-hmm. You guys use them? Probably don't have. Your spaces are different than at the botanical gardens, so probably wouldn't have as many places where you'd even use one.
Yeah, a lot of our, you know, things that we're harvesting, we're growing as more of an example of like an edible landscape. So it's very few places where things are like in tiny rows where you can just go down the row. I know we did a few years ago, we grow in some of our garden areas cover crops. And so we had considered getting a cover crop to help us do termination of some of our cover crops. We never quite got to the point of purchasing, but maybe that needs to be on our garden wish list for next summer.
You know, you probably ought to talk to the director of horticulture about that. Who's only sitting 4 feet away from you.
I was listening to the Larry Mueller show, and this woman came on, and she said...
Oh, man, we're having some fun on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with Samantha Peckham, who's director of horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens, and horticulturist at the gardens, Aaron Presley, our guest. Questions? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And just a little preview, at 12:30 today, we'll take a look at the Monk Botanical Garden in Wausau. So we'll be doing that later on. JT in Menominee Falls emailed, during this year's Nomo May, his grasses have produced tall stems topped with what looks like small seeds. If he lets them grow, will they drop seed and thicken up in the grass? If so, how long must he leave them grow? Depends on what plants that are coming up with the seeds, because they might be weeds.
Yeah, that's always a possibility, especially in turf grasses. But I have heard that before, that if you let, I know my grandfather would always do this, if you let the lawn go to seed initially in the spring and drop that seed, that actually helps to thicken it up. But it would just be being sure that it's the lawn seed that you want and not quack grass or something like that.
Yeah. So if you're identifying that as grass, it's not going to hurt anything.
I don't see a problem with it,
It's not going to hurt anything at all. The hurt will come when you go to mow.
You're going to be baling
your,
it.
18-inch high grass.
Yes.
Which is going to be a long, slow process.
Yes.
Not one that I would want to take up myself. Oh my gosh, you brought some more. You know, I want to go back to edibles for a minute because I want to take a bite out of this. Looks like a mini orange about the size of a ping pong ball, or a little, it'd be a large ping pong ball. What have I got in my hand here?
So that is a calamondin. And so it's another citrus relative, member of the citrus family, and it also has quite a kick to it, much like the kumquat, maybe even a little bit more. But it's one that you can eat the whole thing. You can eat the skin,
a
little bit of a punch.
So how hard to grow?
I mean, if you have a conservatory, it's very easy to grow.
Oh, I just got some of the juice. Ooh,
yes.
It's really a...
But a lovely flavor.
It's a good tart.
Yeah, really wonderful flavor. I think great in, like, summer beverages, things like that, jams, jellies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I like that. And what is it again?
So that's a calamondin.
Calamondin. Okay, I'll be looking those up when they over at the garden next time. Kathy and Madison, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. Well, you know, these lily leaf beetles emerged last year, and I didn't know anything about them, and I know Extension issued a bulletin last year. They seem kind of new to Wisconsin. Probably not really, but... And they're bright red, you know, and they just demolish the Orientals and the Asiatics and stuff. So this year, I thought, okay, I'm going to see what I can do. So I'm experimenting with using insecticidal soap, and I have about 40 lilies, I guess. They're scattered amongst other plants. And so I'm out there every 2 days just targeting the beetles, the larvae, everything I find. And I had tried drowning the beetle in some soap, and it did die. So I think it's working.
Insecticidal soap and drowning it?
And spraying the stems and spraying the entire stem. If I find one that's badly infected, I just throw it away. But like the whole stalk, you know. But so far, I think I'm holding them at bay. And I just thought I'd mention that because I didn't know what the heck to do about these things. I hate to lose all my lilies.
Yeah, they're really problematic. And we've just been starting to see them at Ulbrich as well. And that's one that if you can stay on top of it with manual removal and things like the insecticidal soap, I think that's a great thing to do, especially for home gardeners. You know, if you have a lot of lilies, then it can be you may need to look for some other methods. But if you can do it that way and stay on top of it, I think it's a great solution.
So I'm trying to remember what the lily leaf beetle, how it's constructed. It's not is it a fairly soft bodied beetle? Because if it's a hard body you're not going to get much.
Yeah, that might be more helping just to mechanically like wash them off. I don't know if it would actually be killing them, but it would certainly kill the larva if they're soft bodied.
Yes.
That would be great. But that might just be more manually kind of washing the adults off the leaves.
Yeah. Kathy, thanks so much for that comment. Andrea in Madison will go to you. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I was going to suggest for the lily leaf beetle, you have the larvae cover themselves with their own poop. So you got to clean that off, and I usually just sort of squash them. But I had a question for you two about bindweed. I've got a mulched area and just an awful problem with bindweed. Pulling is not doing the job. Any suggestions?
Yes. Bindweed is it's probably one of my least favorite weeds because it's so challenging to deal with. It's related to morning glories, and when they do flower, they put out a ton of seeds, and they can flower in a very not obvious way, so you don't always catch them. I think one of the best ways to get rid of them, which is a little bit time-consuming, but like you've mentioned, pulling is really hard to do because they just tend to snap off right at the soil level. But if you can put out little sticks out in the garden, so it could be little branches, you know, that are maybe 2 to 3 feet long, you could use chopsticks, really anything that you can stick into the ground and get the vines to actually start to twine up those. Then you can take that and if you do what we would call the glove method with herbicide, then you can use like a little... a sponge paintbrush, or you can actually put, you know, have a plastic glove on and then have a cloth glove on top of that and use that to manually put herbicide on those leaves that are twining up that. That is a great method for being able to kill off the entire plant.
There you go. Thank you so much for that question. Bob in Sun Prairie, what's on your mind?
I'm calling regarding removal of grass and or weeds under trees prior to mulching. And we have tried some organic products just to, because of concern about damaging trees. And the organic product we have used contains acids. It's a commercial product. And it's fine if you use it in heavy doses. And it does kill the shorter grass, but the taller vegetation just not as impacted by it. And I'm reluctant to use something like Roundup just for health concerns, as well as what the impact on the trees may be.
We will ponder that question, Bob. We'll think about that for a bit. Because we're going to take a little quick break here, you're listening to Garden Talk, and we'll have some comments on how to get rid of grass under your trees, and we'll answer your questions as well as we move along today, because we'll be talking together actually right up till 1, but at least with our two guests, Aaron Presley and Samantha Peckham, until 12:30. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. We're talking with Olbrich Botanical Gardens Director of Horticulture, Samantha Peckham, and also with horticulturist Aaron Presley. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments as we move along today. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. We had open lines, get you on pretty quickly. Jane in Wausau emailed that after seeing a gorgeous Ito peony at Olbrich several years ago, she ordered one. And after over 5 years in the ground, it has yet to bloom. She moved it about 3 years ago to a more sunny spot, being careful in how she put it in the ground as instructed. Still not blooming. Any suggestions? Now, she's in Wausau, so she's further north.
I think the Wausau part of this is key, because the Ito peonies are hybrid peonies that are actually more woody in nature, and so they are... you know, not like your herbaceous peonies that are starting to bloom now that die back to the ground every year and then they pop up and then they are really full and have the big, beautiful, fragrant flowers. There are all different types of peonies, and some of them are more woody, where they have an actual woody structure and are like a small shrub and bloom on that older woody growth. And I know my folks are up in Wausau, I grew up there, and I actually bought my mom a peony like that one time, thinking, oh, we just got to give this a try. And as far as I know, any of the tree-type peonies just are not hardy enough up there to survive above ground. So it might be able to, you know, its root system is living from year to year, and it's able to put up new foliage and just leaves from year to year, but that doesn't mean it has the energy or that woody structure that's going to allow it to be able to bloom, unfortunately. But I bet you might have, you know, some friends just a zone or two south of you that would be very happy to adopt your really expensive peony. Yeah. Or the other thing is, you know, climate disruption is just affecting us in all different ways, and if you're finding that it is hardy for you just foliage-wise, one of these years it might be getting warm enough that it does have some above-ground parts that are surviving and allowing it to overwinter and bloom. But that's probably a zone hardiness issue for you up there.
You know, I forgot about Bob, who had called about his tree, and he wanted to get rid of the grass under his tree. And because he wants to put a mulch in there. And my question is, why wouldn't you just put the mulch down? I mean, mow it down to the ground, mow the grass down right to the ground, and then put a mulch. And you wouldn't want something that's going to cover, but it's not going to stop the water from coming through. But a mulch 3 inches or so?
I mean, you could. The one thing with working under trees is that you want to make sure that you're really protecting the root zone and also protecting the root flare, which is the part of the tree where sort of the trunk transitions into the roots. And so you'll notice on a lot of trees, it actually has a visible, like, widening out towards the base.
Yeah, it's going to be a flare.
And you want to make sure that that doesn't get covered up and you're not covering that up with mulch. So I would probably suggest something like a composted leaf mulch, which would degrade fairly quickly and also add a lot of nutrients to the soil. Or, you know, this could be a really good opportunity for some of like the green mulching and like the matrix style plantings that we were talking about. Like you can do really beautiful mixed plantings of sedges and spring ephemerals and woodland plants and things like that, that will do really well under trees where, you know, regular turf grass really struggles.
Yeah. The other problem is if you plant too much under there, you're competing with the roots of the tree, and you can kind of, you're, because the roots of the tree are typically, they're pretty shallow. I mean, they're not.
Yes.
Yeah. Way down there.
Yeah. A lot of folks think if you have a big tree that it looks essentially like the canopy, but underground, but they really have, most trees have a much shallower, wider root system. But, you know, a lot of our native woodland plants are adapted to growing in that kind of environment and can grow, in balance with trees, or you can just do simple mulch and things like that.
Yeah. I do the leaf mulch, I think would be composted leaf mulch.
Yeah.
And just keep at it.
Mm-hmm.
And just keep, and you know, and then you can go in there and pick stuff up.
Yeah.
Pick it off as it comes up. That's what I do too. Susie and Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have some common milkweed that's growing where it shouldn't be growing, and I would like to transplant it, and I'll tell you what I'm doing. They grow so fast. They're 7 to 9 inches tall, and what I've been doing is digging down about half the length of that plant, so about four inches, and they pull up very easily. But I'm not seeing any roots, what I would classify as a root on them. And what I did was that what I have dug up, I've dug up about 10 of them. I've transplanted them into pots, and they seem to be doing pretty well. But I don't know if I'm doing this right. Is there a better way of doing this? I want them to survive. I don't want them to die.
I can see where you would really be struggling with that, because I was had some common milkweed at just the area at work that it was not really playing nicely with some of the other plants in that area. So before monarchs can be coming in and doing too much, you know, laying of eggs on there, I was trying to dig it out. And it's amazing how long those runners are that are coming off the milkweed. And it was interesting too, because there isn't really what you would think of as a typical root ball or, you know, much soil that was really lifting off with them. It's just kind of this long, stringy, interconnected mat. So I think if the ones that, I mean, it sounds like your technique was as good as it could be. And if the ones that you're trying to transplant look like they're doing well so far, you're on the right track, because I don't think there's really a much better way to get it to transplant out and have like a dense, fibrous root system. That's just not the type of plant it is.
No. There you go. You're on the right track, Susie. Thank you. Roger in Cottage Grove, your turn. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It looked like spring was coming early in the Cottage Grove area, so I planted my garden early. And the germination is very spotty at this point in time. Wondering if I planted it too early when nights were down in the 40s and 50s, mid-40s and 50s, but daytime temperatures were quite warm. And secondly, would you replant at this point in time?
Now, what kind of garden are we talking about here? What plants are seeds?
Vegetable garden, kale, Swiss chard, beans, carrots, vegetable garden plants.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, part of it may have been a little bit early, and we've also had quite a bit of rain. So some of the things, like, you know, like carrots especially, may have just been a little bit too wet and a little too cool for them. But I certainly don't think you've missed the window to still be starting things from seed. I think you could go back over and just reseed in some of those areas if you're not seeing anything.
Yeah, I don't see one. You know, for sure, there are a lot of things that should not be put in too early, like tomatoes and peppers especially. But you can, if you're doing seeds, go on out there and fill it back in, Roger. I wouldn't wait. Kathy in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. I listened to the comment about tree peonies, and I live in Washburn in Bayfield County. I moved 2 tree peonies from Illinois. They will never do as well as they did down there, but they bloom every year.
Well, you're in Washburn, Kathy, and Washburn is an ideal place for a lot of things.
It's a lovely spot.
This is probably why you moved there in the first place.
Yeah, it's funny because it's even though you're so much farther north, you are very close to Lake Superior, and that's actually probably giving you a bit of a temperate effect of that sort of lake effect in kind of a counterintuitive way being that far north. But
are you going to come over and see me on next week, Friday, Kathy?
Oh, got the tickets. There'll be five of us, 4 of us.
All right. Well, you be sure to come and say hi and remind me that we talked on the radio. That's great. Thanks.
I will. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. And just in case you're just tuning in, we'll be broadcasting from Bayfield and Bloom next Friday, and the whole WPR gang will be up there. Sarah Ashworth will be there, our director of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'll be there. Jill Nadeau will be there. Clara Neipert, all kinds of people from the station. But we're asking you to come. It's free. It'd be nice if you would go to, what is it, why did I not have that information in front of me? There's a chance to get some tickets, and I'm suddenly blanking on how to do that. But Jill's going to say, what the heck? And she'll email it to me. Dennis in Afton, Minnesota, it is your turn.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks, everyone. I really appreciate the show. Hope to get up to Bayfield and visit. But in my neighborhood here, I spotted some Japanese knotwood. And I'm wondering if there's a non-herbicide treatment for that. I'm not getting good news. And Google has some offerings. And I have a comment about a rabbit enjoying dandelion, if you want that.
That sounds like a lot more fun than the Japanese knotweed, yeah, to be honest.
Give me the rabbit.
Pardon?
You said you had a story that you wanted to tell us?
Oh, about the rabbit. Yeah, that is interesting. I got my outdoor kitchen, and this rabbit, just a young one, bopped in about 6 feet away, and he proceeded to chew at the bottom of the stem, and then the entire stem, about 8 inches long, would disappear, and he'd eat right down to the blossom, and he did that 9 times, and then a robin chased him away.
That's a great story. But now back to the sadder story. This is a much sadder story when we're talking Japanese knotweed. Isn't it?
That is a rough one and a very challenging weed to contend with. I would say if you can, depending on how big the patch is, if you can dig it out and, you know, manually pull it out, fantastic. But if it's to the size where you don't feel like you could pull it out yourself, that would definitely be a case where maybe some, chemical means would be helpful in that, because once that gets away from you, it's really, really hard to control, and it can spread into other properties very quickly.
Yeah. It's very, very difficult.
Yes. Yeah. It's a
We're
huge problem.
We're getting all
the
hardest
Coast.
Ones yeah. today on the, yes. on the
thistles,
show.
Thistles, knotweed, all sorts of things.
Canada thistle, knotweed. Oh my gosh. Dennis is good. Best we can do. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Here's one for you. Kath in Sauk County emailed that her cat mint cuttings are doing great, but the bed they are growing in has jumping worms. How can she transfer the plants without transferring the worms? And you could probably pick the worms out, but the eggs are another matter.
Yeah, I think that's really, really risky.
Yeah.
And honestly, something like, you know, catmint or really whatever plant you have is not so valuable that it's worth, you know, transplanting and working with and introducing jumping worms into an area that's not currently infested, because the you might be able to see, you know, what you identify, what you think are worms, but what you're probably not able to catch or sort out is the cocoons, which are like, you know, smaller than
really small.
A pinhead. They're so small. Yeah.
You can't see them. Well, you can, but you get your microscope, your magnifying glass out. So you're, unfortunately, that is, I would not transfer those plants anywhere. Unless you're just doing it in your own lawn.
Yeah, if you're doing it in places where you already have them. But I wouldn't, like what Aaron was saying, I don't think it's worth it.
No, it's definitely not. Lois in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Lois.
Hi there. I just went to a class. It was called Bite Back Against Invasive Species. And it says that you should eat the Japanese knotweed. If you pull up the, when they start rooting, just start poking up. You can cut them off, and you can peel off the outer layer, and they taste like rhubarb. And you can make rhubarb pie with it even. So just FYI.
That is a new one. I've never heard that.
Lois, where did you attend this meeting?
Well, it was through the Chippewa Valley Learning Center. So
okay.
In Menominee.
All right. It's a respectable, definitely respectable place. So I wanted to make sure there wasn't anything... well, I wanted to make sure, let's put it that way, on the positive note, that it was some place like that that really is legitimate. Thank you. Appreciate that call. Brad emailed to remind Bob that a layer of cardboard before the mulch under his trees, and that will smother the weeds. So he's, and Brad's right, if you laid down some cardboard, I mean, cardboard will let the moisture through. So the weeds are going to be less likely. You put the mulch over the top, the weeds aren't going to come up, and the cardboard will eventually disintegrate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's if you want to go with the mulching thing, I think that's a great way to just add a little bit more to it.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. There were some, you know, before I forget to mention it, there are some trips that are coming up at Olbrich. I mean, we've got plenty of time to talk about it, but before I forget, tell us what's coming on.
Yes, we have a couple really great ones coming up. Aaron is going to be leading one to Portland later this fall, if you want to tell folks a little bit about that one. It sounds like a really great opportunity.
Yeah. So we work with a wonderful travel company that's out of the Elm Grove area. It's Country Travel Discoveries. So all of their info is on their website for these tours, as well as through the Olbrich website. But we'll be heading out to the Pacific Northwest. And so our home base will be in Portland, Oregon. And we'll be checking out a lot of the really renowned public gardens that are out there, the International Rose Test Garden, Portland Japanese Garden. They have a really wonderful Chinese garden, which is among my favorite gardens actually in Portland. But and then kind of radiating out from the city, we've actually arranged for some tours at some more agricultural type establishments. We'll be going to a clematis garden, and then we have some really magnificent home garden tours that private people are opening up their home gardens to us. We'll be visiting the garden of Dan Himes, who's the founder of Terra Nova Nurseries. Mm-hmm. They're a big breeder of lots of heuchera that you might have in your gardens, and some other really special kind of private places that are not usually open to the casual visitor. So that's on September 9th to 14th, just this upcoming fall. Hopefully the weather will be really, should be really beautiful out there at that time of year too.
So that's something you want to, I'd go right to your site, I imagine, to sign up for it. You have a link to the agency that's doing it, too.
Yep, you could either go through our website, www.olbrich.org, and then under our tours and travel section, it'll point you to that one, as well as another tour that's slated for February of 2025.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this one we're really excited about. We are going to be taking a group to Mexico to see the monarchs. And so we're super excited about this one. Two of our staff are going to go along on this one with folks when they go on this. And I think it's a really, really great opportunity to get into the mountains to see where all of these monarchs overwinter and to get to see the forests. They're also going to be adding some stops in, I believe, in Mexico City. We're going to see a Frida Kahlo Museum and a local performance, things like that. So it'll be a really wonderful combination of ecology and then arts and things like that.
So that's is that already up for signing up for?
It is, yep. And that one is in the same place that Aaron mentioned. You can find all the information on our website. And it's through the same tour group that we've used before.
And you can kind of tour around your gardens on a tram, too.
You bet.
If you don't want to go to Mexico, you can go to Olbrich Gardens and get on a tram.
You might think you're in Thailand for part of the time.
You never know. Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes. Our tram is up and running again. So that will be running, I believe we're running daily now. We started on Mother's Day weekend, and that tours around our gardens, and it has an audio tour that runs with it, so you can learn a little bit more about what's going on in the gardens while you're riding the tram, and you can get on and off as well, so it's a nice way to just get around the garden and hear a little more about what's going on.
And I want to get back to this green banana-looking thing that I'm holding in my hands right now, and it looks like a banana to me. And this is something growing that you're growing over at the gardens, Erin?
Yeah, we thought while our conservatory is closed until about the middle of June for the assessment, we'd bring you a little taste of the tropics, as well as an homage to your lime plant, Limey, who I assume is alive and well.
Limey is not.
Don't tell me.
Limey passed. Despite my best, you know, and I had limey for so many years. I hundreds and hundreds of limes.
Oh, off poor
of
limey.
Her.
I'm sorry for your loss. I can see the tears, actually.
I mean, I've had some people even offer to give me another one. Aww. And I've been reluctant, but this summer I'm going to get a new one, a new limey. That I can hopefully talk into living a long, long time. But well, Limey lived a long, long time.
Yeah. So
but
this is
back to the banana.
Yes, what you got here is a Java Blue banana. And aside from the normal bananas people get in the grocery store, which is actually only one specific variety of banana that is a clonal plant propagated throughout the globe, there is just huge diversity amongst bananas. So this is a different type of banana. It's called Java Blue. And the one you have right now, it does have kind of a bluish cast to the skin right now, and it's not ripe. So if you just put it on your, you know, countertop at home, wait till the skin gets yellow.
Yellow.
Yeah, so you can picture it out there. It's about 5 inches long and about 2 times the thickness of a regular banana. And it'll have a wonderful kind of pineapple essence when it's ripe and ready to eat.
Yeah, I can't wait to try. How long do you think it'll take to ripen? A few weeks?
Yeah, maybe I would give it a couple of weeks probably.
Well,
patience.
It'll be worth it, though.
It definitely will. I'm really looking forward to trying it out because I like trying new things. I lived in Trinidad for a year in the West Indies. I was on a project there. And so every banana, I mean, there were bananas that were 3 inches long. And I tried every, you know, up to monsters. And I tried them all and I loved them all. I did indeed. Well, thank you both very much. It's been a lot of fun. And hopefully we can do this again.
Yes.
Really glad to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Good time to do it. Really looking forward to talking again with Erin Presley and Samantha Peckham. But coming up, we're going to take a look at another botanical garden, the Monk Botanical Garden. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. And, you know, a few minutes ago, I mentioned that we were doing Bayfield in Bloom again. We'll be in Bayfield, Wisconsin for that. Next Friday, we're doing a live show from there. It's a free event. We do like to have people request tickets, even though it's free. And I didn't have the address off the top of my head, but I have it now. It's WPR.org/presents, WPR.org/presents. And fill in how many tickets you need or how many people are coming, and that'll help us out a little bit with the arrangements. But it is indeed free. You know, we're fortunate to have many beautiful botanical gardens in Wisconsin. And right now we're going to take a closer look at one of the newest, the Monk Botanical Garden in Wausau. And our guest is Darcy Howard, who is executive director of the gardens. And I'm wondering, have you visited the Monk Botanical Gardens? Do you have a favorite part? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Darcy Howard, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Monk Botanical Gardens, kind of relatively newcomer, I guess, to the state's public gardens. How did it get started?
So we celebrated our 20th anniversary last year, but it started in a very unique way compared to some of the other gardens here in Wisconsin. And in 2003, a local realtor named Robert W. Monk III donated 19 acres to the newly formed nonprofit. In order to turn it into an educational botanical garden. And this site, these 19 acres, were adjacent to another 6.5 acres, which included his homestead. So in the very beginning, Mr. Monk was quite involved in helping create our first master plan, which was in 2005. But what's really unique is that it was all volunteers. So it's been all volunteer run up until 2017. We had some seasonal staff, but not a full-time staff member until about 7 years ago.
Man, and I'm looking online at the gardens, and you've got a fantastic thing going there. I mean, it must have looked a lot different than it does now.
It did. You know, he, him and his family, when the land was bought in 1974, they had planted a lot of red pine, which we still have plenty of as we continue to develop. But Mr. Monk was a gardener. So one of his favorite things were crabapple trees, which we have throughout the gardens. And as we develop sections of it, we try to keep what we can that Mr. Monk originally planted. However, I have to give kudos to those volunteers because really starting in 2010, they started building some of the sections of gardens that visitors will see now, which is our wildflower woods and our meditation garden, and also our kitchen potager. So, again, those are volunteers working full-time jobs plus trying to run a botanical garden, all being open to the public the entire time.
It's an amazing story. Tell us more about the individual areas that you have.
Sure. So one of the first gardens that was created was our memory circle. And it is surrounded by a variety of ferns with some river birches that have created this nice overhead canopy where the shade is wonderful. And those ferns, especially with this rain that we've had, are really flourish. And it is just a beautiful, peaceful spot. And from there, we have our wildflower woods. So the concept behind that was, again, 15 years ago, we planted the trees, most of them native, not all of them, that would create the canopy. And so the canopy was finally tall enough and creating enough shade that we have begun to fill in the areas with native wildflowers throughout.
And I love you've got swamp white oak in there, you've got bur oak, you've got maple, Northwood maple.
Yes, yeah. Again, I can't talk enough about those original volunteers, some of which were horticulturalists that put in so much time and effort to make these beautiful designs. And that spot, one of my favorite spots within the Wildflower Woods, is Herbie's Garden. And this garden was funded by and planted by one of those original board members, Claire Aziz, who wanted something in memory of her father. And she's created a beautiful native little nook that you can stroll along and see all of the spring wildflowers coming up. And of course, this time of year, it looks the best. And that's one of my favorite spots to go. But we also have some magnolias, which, up here, we're farthest north, Botanical Garden. So you see those magnolias, they're not going to last long, but man, you're like, yes, spring is here. So.
Oh, man. I like the... You've got an educational, you mentioned you have the educational garden, and the gallery there looks outstanding.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Monk, again, I find this to be kind of a uniqueness about this garden, is he really wanted education to be as equal as the development of the botanical garden. And so we have, again, volunteers really started that effort, working with the Wausau School District, providing some programs. But the gardens themselves, we have made sure that every perennial and annual is marked so that people can identify them. And then, as you're probably seeing on the website, we then transfer that. People can just, look at a QR code and learn all about what plants are there and, could they plant them in their yard? And, I think that's an important piece of what we do. The other is that it's really key for botanical gardens in the future, and frankly, any sort of natural environment, for it to continue, we need the littlest ones to start to understand it and appreciate it. And so we really have committed to that 3-4-year-old programming, and actually offer the only garden nature-based preschool in the area.
It's an amazing thing. You mentioned the meditation garden earlier, and I believe there's still work being done in the meditation garden. What's the plan for that area?
Yeah, great question. So phase one of the meditation garden was completed, and it's come to maturity. So as you walk from the wildflower woods, you enter the meditation garden, which overlooks the pond. And it is a place where we consistently hear people find their serenity, their peace. They love to have lunch there and look out over the water. And so we do have a couple more phases to go. And that's really extending the meditation garden around more of the pond that is there, which, by the way, was dug by Mr. Monk and his children at the time. And there's an island on that pond, and so that is also included in that expansion, plus a tea house. So we will be putting in a tea house eventually.
Darcy Howard is our guest today. She is the executive director of the Monk Botanic Gardens in Wausau. Questions for her. Have you been there? Have you experienced? Love to hear from you if you have. If you have questions from her, maybe even about the plants, I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Darcy Howard, Executive Director of the Monk Botanic Gardens in Wausau. I tell you what, it's a fascinating place, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions about it or maybe your experiences. Again, the number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas to talk@WPR.org. John in Wausau, let's go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi, just wanted to call and thank you for this wonderful garden. It's such an amazing resource for the Wausau Central Wisconsin area. Bring our granddaughters there all the time, and probably one of my favorite memories. We've always heard of that a place is healthy when you see a lot of frogs and turtles and those sort of things. And there was one I visited, and there were hundreds and hundreds of tiny little frogs that had come out of the pond and were warming themselves or whatever on the sidewalk, gravel area. And my granddaughters were in heaven. They were having so much fun playing with all the little frogs.
John, thanks for calling. Comment, Darcy.
Yeah, thanks, John. It's one of our favorite times. We usually have snapping turtles that nest every year and green herons. But I'll tell you, there's nothing better than when all those baby toads and frogs come out. It is a delight for everybody.
Oh, John, again, appreciate it very much. An email from a Wausau resident wants to know, is there a rationale for turning the gardens from a free community resource to a paid attraction?
Yeah, it's a great question. So Mr. Monk, and with the original vision, was to create, and we you know, in fact, we just read this out of minutes from 2004. He wanted a world-class garden, and he compared what he wanted to Chicago, to St. Louis's garden. And so we are fully nonprofit. So we are not supported by taxpayer money. And so we run on donations and memberships. And so similar to Green Bay Botanical Gardens, we are going to have to change over to begin to charge so that we have the funding and other resources to finish the full 30 acres that we have to develop.
And you mentioned 30 acres. You have expanded, or you've added to the original property, let's put it that way. What are the plans for that new area?
Yeah, well, exciting news is that we are starting a big part of that expansion this year, and we're calling it Phase 1 Garden Enhancements. And some of the stuff is necessary for us to move on as a botanical garden. And what I mean by that is we need to secure the space. So things like new fencing and top-of-the-line security. We are installing a parking lot, moving our entrance, and a parking lot that when you drive in, you're going to know you're already in the botanical garden. So it's just beautifully designed. We're working with TKWA out of Milwaukee. And then a gatehouse, and that will allow us to increase our visitor services. Right now, we just don't have a way to collect fees, but also just to get that information out and talk to our members and talk to the community as they come through. But the two most exciting pieces, in my opinion, is one, we are putting in an English-style garden. It will be a little more than an acre, and we're building it or creating it in a way that will also hold ceremonies, wedding ceremonies for up to 100 people. And that is going to be that wow factor as people come in, one of the first things they're going to see. And the second is we are completing Sarah's storybook garden. And so this is a garden that started 6 years ago as a memorial garden for Sarah Kurt Sands, who was an attorney in town that was killed during a domestic violence issue here in Wausau. And the Marathon Bar Association started to raise the money, and we've completed part of the garden with a hobbit house. The ferry tunnel's going in, and we've got a shipwreck, and it's just going to be a magical place where kids and adults can really just expand their imagination while surrounded by beautiful plants.
The gardens are an official monarch butterfly site. Maybe explain what that means.
Yeah, so this is another thing that was done by volunteers before staff arrived. And we have made a point of trying to keep native spaces and open spaces that have butterfly and pollinator plants. And so as that designation basically means that we're providing that habitat and the associated education around that. And one of our next gardens to go in will be a native prairie. And we're hoping to begin that process next year.
That's great. And you're also, I thought this was pretty cool, you're also a chimney swift and geocaching site. Tell us about those designations.
Yeah, so again, geocaching was long before staff, and we do have a couple of spots on site. And occasionally we get geocachers out. And really that was developed by the volunteers as a way to get people to the gardens originally, which was brilliant. And then the Swift Tower, we partner with the Wausau Bird Club here on many programs and other things, and one of the things is putting up a Swift Tower. Now, I have to say, unfortunately, we've never had any chimney swifts stay in the tower, but we are moving it this year, hopefully to a better spot. So, fingers crossed.
Well, I tell you, chimney swifts need it. There aren't so many chimneys. The chimneys are rapidly disappearing from the face of the United States, actually. So anything that can be done to help save them, I think, is a good thing. I think you mentioned a visitor center, a plan to build a visitor center. What would it be like, and what would you hope to do to use it for?
Sure. So our phase two will be the visitor and education center. And right now you can check out the design on our website. But what we're looking at is walking into, meeting visitors, having a very small gift shop, having a beautiful orangey-like space where it's all glass and we've got plants year-round in there that during the good weather can be completely opened up, and you're sitting out on a veranda with a two-way fireplace. And looking out at the gardens. It also will have a 40-person workshop, again, focusing on our education programs. And believe it or not, but staff are not on site. Our offices are not on site. We're very grateful that UWSP Wausau has hosted us from the beginning. And but as you can imagine, that create some challenges. And so another big important piece of that visitor center is our office space will be part of that as well.
Yeah. I guess I haven't asked this, but the garden itself is located where around Wausau?
Yeah, we're on the north side. So if you're coming up 51 and heading north, you get right off at where NTC is, North Technical College, and we are just south of NTC on Campus Drive.
Okay. And the visitor center, when do you hope to complete it?
Whew. Well, I got to say, I want to get phase one done this year. And then one thing at a time. And then we'll start raising funds in order to put in the visitor center. So the hope right now is that a visitor center would be installed in 27.
One of the things I noticed on your site that interested me is that you have some opportunities that people can, that you can work with people on maybe designing their own landscape and things of that nature.
Yes, we do offer landscape consulting. A big part of our focus is native plants. As we all know, we need our native pollinators. And so again, that has been a focus of what we're trying to do within these beautiful curated gardens, but also help people to do the same. So even the smallest space, as you know, you can plant the right plants to help with our native pollinators. And so, it's very affordable. We take a look. We go. We take a look at your yard. A horticulturist will then give you some suggestions, tell you where you can get your plants. We don't do any installation, but we are here as experts.
And tell us about some of the events that you have planned for this summer.
Sure. So summertime, as always, in any Wisconsin botanical garden is busy. And so we have a booze and botany event. It'll be our fifth year. And that event is focused on using our kitchen garden plants to make dishes and mixed drinks, both with and without alcohol. And pairing the two. And so we get local chefs and bartenders to come out, and it's always a great time. All the money actually goes to support our Sprouts Garden Preschool, because we do offer scholarships so that anybody can attend. And then we have Blossom of Lights coming in the fall, which is on its third year, and it's our version of a light show. It is not wrapped around the holiday. We do it mid-September through October, and it really is a beautiful space to come and enjoy the lights and see how that enhances everything around in the gardens.
I wondered how long you stay open throughout the year. I did see a beautiful little walkway in the wooded area. And there was also a photo of that walkway that was snow-covered.
Yeah, we are open year-round. We offer snowshoe walks, just general winter walks. And because we offer programming year-round, we want to make sure it's open to visitors as well. People come out and cross-country ski on a nice new fresh snow. It's just a great place to be no matter what time of year.
And a staff, you started with volunteers, but how many staff do you have and how many volunteers?
Yeah, so we started with one staff member, which was me, first full-time staff member, and now we are at 15. Some of those are part-time, and we have additional seasonal staff and over 110 volunteers, and that does not include the businesses that come out and volunteer their time as well. We usually get multiple groups in the area to come out and spend their day digging in the dirt.
Well, I tell you what, it's a fascinating place, and I have to admit, I haven't been there yet, but I'm certainly, after talking with you and going online to your website at the Monk Gardens, that it is a fantastic place, and I'll be there. I'm going to try and stop there this summer, as a matter of fact. Thank you so much. Darcy Howard is the executive director of the Monk Botanic Gardens in Wausau. And if you're in the area, you should stop in and take a look at it. Our producers, we have a couple of producers, Clara Neipert and Joe Patnod. Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn, and executive producer Jill Nadeau. I am Larry Mueller.